welcome here to session 10 on the Gospel of Mark. We're going to cover miracles and misunderstanding. There's a lot in this session. It's going to be loaded, so we got to move through these different scenes in the Gospel of Mark. We're going to look at a whole series of miracles, and throughout those miracles and incidents, we're going to see that Jesus continues to be misunderstood, not just by the religious authorities or by the crowds, but also by his own disciples. So the first miracle is one in which isn't a healing, isn't an exorcism of or casting out of a demon spirit or anything like that. It is Jesus walking on the water. So in Mark chapter 6, verse 45, we'll pick up the gospel here. It says, and immediately, again, as Mark likes to use this adverb immediately to just keep on propelling forward the storyline, immediately he, Jesus, made his disciples enter into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side, for the other side of the Sea of Galilee, toward Bethsaida. Bethsaida is here in the north, kind of northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee, while he himself sent the crowd away. And after he said goodbye to them, he departed onto the mountain to pray. So Jesus has his disciples begin the journey across the lake. He sends the crowd away, and then he goes to pray on the mountain. And when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the lake, which is the Sea of Galilee, and he was alone on the land. So Jesus was still on the western shore of the Sea of Galilee, but his disciples were in the middle of the lake. And he could see them because the Sea of Galilee is really small. It's not very big. It's a lake. You can see across the whole thing very easily. And he sees them in the middle struggling as they rowed because the wind was against them. And he came out at about the fourth watch of the night. So in the middle of the night, essentially, walking on the lake. And he intended to pass by near them. So they're out there rowing and the wind is contrary to them. So they're trying to row against the wind. And Jesus walks out in the middle of the night. And his intention is to just walk by next to them or near them. When they, the disciples, when they saw him, Jesus, walking on the lake, they supposed he was a ghost. And they cried out because they all saw him and were terrified. I don't know if this reaction is really unrealistic. No matter who you are, they are seeing something so totally unexpected. I think as a reader, we see this and we're like, yeah, I would be too. We can relate with the shock factor that's involved here. But immediately, Jesus spoke with them. So he's near the boat. He's going to be walking by, but they see him and they freak out. He spoke with them and said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid." And so rather than keep walking, he decides to get into the boat. He got into the boat with them and the wind ceased. And they were greatly amazed among themselves because they had not gained any insight from the miracle of the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So they see Jesus walking. He speaks to them. He gets in the boat. The winds die down. They're amazed. And Mark says that this was because they didn't learn anything from the feeding of the 5,000. And the description here is kind of really intense. Their hearts were hardened. This is an expression in the Gospel of Mark that is used, and also outside of the Gospel of Mark in Scripture, for somebody who is resistant to God, resistant to the knowledge of God, resistant to acknowledging God, resistant to obeying God. Here, I think this is probably resistant to understanding what Jesus is doing and the ways that he's teaching them about the kingdom of God. They're still just not quite getting it. The disciples are displaying not just a lack of faith, but due to that, they're also displaying a lack of understanding. So they're in the middle of the Sea of Galilee. And then next, Jesus is going to heal the sick. So they're on the other side of the lake. Somewhere now, they come over here to the area of Gennesaret. So they're from over here in Bethsaida. Then they come back over to the area of Gennesaret. Verse 53, and when they crossed over the lake, They came to land at Gennesaret and tied the boat to the shore. And when they'd come out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him. They recognized Jesus. And they ran around that whole region and they began to carry on beds those who were sick to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he went, whether into villages or into cities or into the countryside, they laid those who were sick in the marketplaces and begged him to let them touch even the fringe of his garment. And everyone who touched him was healed. This short little incident here in the region of Gennesaret, people are brought to Jesus and they just touch the edge of his clothing and many are healed. This kind of underlines the fame. It really focuses on how well known Jesus is. People run around to the whole region and tell people that Jesus is here, Jesus is here. And people bring people, carry people on beds who are sick and they lay them in the marketplaces begging to just touch Jesus's clothes. And it's kind of a bridge scene here, I think, to showing how the crowds respond to his power. God's healing power is working through Jesus and it's emphasizing his compassion that he has showed in the past and will continue to show. But it also kind of raises the question about the crowd. Does the crowd really believe in Jesus? Are they receiving what he has to offer spiritually? Or are they just seeking the miraculous? That question will be answered as we continue on. However, what Mark does next is he interrupts, and he does so by a conflict. Now, this is actually one of the most extended conflicts where Jesus dialogues with the religious leaders and the Pharisees in the Gospel of Mark. It's a dispute about purity. Mark chapter 7, verse 1. And the Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered together around him. And they had seen that some of his disciples ate bread with defiled, that is, unwashed hands. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands up to the wrist, holding fast to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they bathe themselves. And there are many other things that they receive and hold fast to, such as the washing of cups and pitchers and copper vessels. Verse 5, and the Pharisees and the experts in the law asked him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but instead eat bread with defiled hands? And he, Jesus, said to them, Isaiah prophesied correctly about you hypocrites. As it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And they worship me in vain, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. The Pharisees are criticizing Jesus' disciples for not following the traditions of the elders. And that is the issue here. The issue is, why do your disciples not do what we think they should do? They should be following the traditions like our disciples do and like what John's disciples were doing as well. But Jesus rebukes them for focusing on human traditions while neglecting God's commandments. And what he does is he continues then now to explain how they are hypocrites. So this is, Jesus gets questioned and now he returns and replies back. And he actually spins the argument on them and actually puts them in the hot seat, showing that they're actually the ones who are at fault, not him. So what he says here in verse 8, abandoning the commandments of God, you hold firmly to the traditions of men. He also said to them, you cleverly reject the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever speaks evil of their father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say that if a person says to his father or mother, quote, whatever benefit you might have gained from me is already korban, which means devoted to God, end quote, then you no longer let him do anything for his father or mother. Thus, you are setting aside the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And you do many things like that. Jesus is condemning the Pharisees and the religious leaders for prioritizing the things that they think are important more so than the things of God. And Jesus is kind of redefining here sort of the hierarchy of The traditions of the elders are not meant to supersede God's commandments. Now, he doesn't condemn the traditions in and of themselves. What he condemns is the way that they are placed above the commandments of God. And he uses one illustration here to kind of make the point. He talks about this tradition they have about this thing called korban, which is just a word that means devoted. And it's a tradition where if somebody owned something, say you have land, and your land, or maybe you have like some other property, or you have some stored up wealth, maybe some herds of cattle, and you say, well, that's korban. Now, the law of Moses, Jesus says, is that you're supposed to honor your father and your mother. But in their tradition, if you say something is korban, then you cannot do anything with it, else give it to the temple as something devoted to God. You cannot support your family. You cannot support your father. You cannot support your mother with it. But the law of Moses, Jesus says, the commandment is to honor your father and your mother. So when you say, well, if somebody says something is korban, you then violate the commandment because you don't let them use what they should to support their family like God commands. This indictment is like right on the nose. He's pointing out how they are basically saying that you cannot follow what God says because of our tradition. Because if you say korban, that is more important than what God commanded through Moses. It says, you do a lot of these things. This is just one example. And so Mark is here, I think, putting this sort of like conflict in place to show the growing tension that Jesus has with the religious authorities. And ultimately, this will then lead to the fever pitch at the end of the gospel, where the conflict comes to his arrest and his torture, crucifixion, and death. So Jesus pauses now. In verse 14 here, he turns from the Pharisees and the experts in the law to talk to the crowd. So he, Jesus, called the crowd to himself again, and he said to them, listen to me, all of you, and understand. Nothing that goes into a person from the outside is able to defile him, but the things that come out from a person are what defiles that person. And in some of the oldest manuscripts, verse 16 does not exist. Jesus is here, he's redefining what purity means. Because according to the Pharisees and the experts in the law, if you don't do all these washings before you eat and things like that, then you are ritually unclean and therefore you're not pure. But Jesus is redefining purity and he's focusing on inner moral corruption. And that is what defiles somebody rather than external ritual observance. Now, Mark is placing this particular conflict here as a sort of like a preview of the coming work that Jesus is going to do in some of his subsequent miracles among the Gentiles. Because here, this prepares the way for the inclusion of the Gentiles because it shifts away from a focus on the old covenant practices of observing the law as what really defiles somebody, you're ritualistically unclean, to the future new covenant, heart-oriented or heart-centered righteousness that God actually desires. It's what is in your heart that comes out that is what defiles you, not what goes in. It's not eating the wrong foods or eating them with unwashed hands or the like. So from that point here, the reason why I'm saying I think Mark is setting this up to kind of like point to some of this Gentile inclusion is because that's where Jesus goes next. But before that, he continues to explain things in private to his disciples. Verse 17 says, and when he had entered the house and was away from the crowd, his disciples began asking him about the parable. Now, I don't know if it really is a parable in the traditional sense, but parables are sometimes like just riddles. So when Jesus talks about things that are coming out of you is what defile you and not what goes in, it's a little bit of a riddle. And so that's what they're referring to. And so he said to them, you also do not understand? Do you not understand that whatever goes into a person from the outside is not able to defile him? Because it does not go into his heart, but into his stomach, and then goes out into the sewer. Now then, Mark adds a narrative comment here, parenthesis, by saying this, he, Jesus, declared all foods clean. And then verse 20, and he said, what comes out of a person, that is what defiles a person. For evil thoughts come from within, out from people's hearts, such as sexual immoralities, thefts, murders, adulteries, greed, wickedness, deceit, unrestrained behavior, stinginess, insults, pride, senselessness. All these evil things come from within and defile a person. And that's why Jesus is focusing on inner moral corruption as what truly defiles a person, and not the traditions of the elders that the Pharisees and experts of the law were trying to promote. It's not these unwashed hands and things like that that really defile you. It's a matter of the heart. Now, the next scene is where Jesus heals this Syrophoenician girl, and it's not in the area of Galilee. In verse 24, it says, and he stood up, Jesus stood up, and departed from there into the region of Tyre. And we went to a house and did not want anyone to know about it, and yet he was not able to avoid being noticed. So from around here in the Galilee area, he goes north to Tyre. Tyre is not Israelite territory. It's Gentile territory. It's up in the area of Phoenicia, a Gentile nation. So he goes north to Tyre, and in verse 25, but immediately after hearing about him, a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile. Mark makes sure the reader knows this. The woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she kept begging him, she kept begging Jesus to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, let the children be filled first, for it's not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the pet dogs. Here, Jesus is using the word children as a circumlocution, like another way to refer to the people of Israel. And it's not good to take the children's bread. This could be viewed as the blessings of the kingdom, the things that Jesus is bringing. It's not good to take those blessings and then give them to people outside of Israel, who here, he's using a sort of like a little euphemistic term. Pet dogs are a common phrase that Jewish people used in the time of Jesus to refer to Gentiles. Now, does the woman give up? Does the woman go home? Nope. She replies back. She answered and said to him, Lord. So here, she uses an honorific term, recognizing Jesus as one who has authority, using the word Lord. Even the pet dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. Her reply back shows her persistence. And not only that, but that she knows that the blessings that Jesus is bringing to show the kingdom power, that those aren't meant for just Israel alone. She has some insight in here into saying, but even, and using this metaphor, this sort of like culinary metaphor of the eating at the table, and there's pieces of bread, and some of the bread falls on the floor. The dogs are able to have that, are they not? But Jesus says to her, because you said this, go and see. The demon has gone out of your daughter. And when the woman returned to her house, she found the child lying on the bed, and the demon had gone out. This Gentile woman begs Jesus to heal her demon-possessed daughter, but at first, Jesus seems to refuse her, speaking of the priority of Israel. But her persistent faith ends up leading to her child's healing. This episode challenges the typical Jewish-Gentile boundaries, which I think, again, anticipate the eventual spread of the good news and the power of God beyond Israel's borders, of which we already see some of that happening in the ministry of Jesus. Well, the next scene is that Jesus heals a deaf and mute man. But I want to make one more comment about the woman. I think the Syrophoenician woman, the focus is on her faith, her trust. Because that is what Jesus has been after this whole time with the people that he's been teaching, the crowds, and most specifically with his disciples and even his closest ones, the 12 apostles. and what this record of the healing of her daughter up near Tyre in Phoenicia is that it's about faith. It's about trusting in the power of God, not ethnicity, not genealogy, or any other type of demographic. It's trusting in God and in God's Messiah, Jesus, that opens the blessings of the kingdom, or opens the door to the blessings of the kingdom. And Jesus's initial refusal seems like it might actually be testing the woman if she does truly trust. And her attitude and reply hint at the forthcoming inclusion of the Gentiles' obedience to the faith, meaning that they submit and obey and recognize God as the true king. So the next episode here is Jesus is going to heal another individual. This is the deaf and mute man. Mark chapter 7, verse 31, having departed from the region of Tyre, he again came to the Sea of Galilee by way of Sidon, and then through the middle of the region of the Decapolis. As a first century reader, if you're a first century Israelite and you're reading this, I think you'd be like, why is he doing that? Why is he taking that route? Now, let me show you. Jesus is here in Tyre with the Syrophoenician woman. And it says he goes back to the Sea of Galilee by way of Sidon, going north up here. And then it says he came down through the Decapolis, which is over here on the eastern side of the Jordan River. That is not a typical route. It seems that Mark is trying to show Jesus is up to something here. He's going back to his home base, which is around the Sea of Galilee, but he's doing it in a very roundabout manner. But there's a purpose for this. Verse 32. So he's back at the Sea of Galilee on the eastern side over near the Decapolis area. They brought to him one who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on him. And he took him aside privately, away from the crowd. And he put his fingers into his ears. And then after spitting on his fingers, he touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, which means be open. And immediately his ears were opened, and the thing that bound his tongue was removed, and he began to speak clearly. And he ordered them to tell no one. Here we go again with this whole Jesus is basically telling people, don't spread the news about me. We saw in previous sessions, there's a common theme in the Gospel of Mark, often referred to as the messianic secret, where Jesus tells evil spirits and he also tells people who get healed many times, don't tell anybody. Don't share what has happened. Don't spread the news about me. And there are a couple of reasons that I shared in previous sessions about, well, why would this be the case? Why would Jesus do this? Why is Mark focusing so much on this, quote, messianic secret motif? Well, Jesus's effort doesn't seem to really work because it says the more he ordered them, meaning the more he told them not to tell anybody, the more they continued to proclaim it. It's almost like Jesus's reputation cannot be contained any longer. People, even being told by Jesus, people just can't not say something about what they have seen and heard. In verse 37, they were extremely astonished. In the past, crowds have been amazed and astonished, but this crowd, I think this is particularly why, even as stern as Jesus could tell them not to say anything, they just kept proclaiming it because they were just more than amazed or more than astonished. Extremely. This was so impressive to them. Somebody who was deaf and who couldn't talk, Jesus healing them, and they're now able to hear and to speak clearly, was too much. The power of the kingdom was too great for them to want to keep quiet. And they started saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Now, Jesus is in the Decapolis area and healing this man. They may or may not recognize the correlations that this has with the prophecies of Isaiah. But an Israelite reader in the first century would certainly pick up on it. Where in Isaiah, like, for example, in Isaiah 35, there are prophecies about the coming messianic age when the deaf will hear and the mute will speak. And this healing here seems to point again to Jesus as the fulfillment of Old Testament messianic prophecy and also proving the power of the kingdom that is at work in him. Next, Jesus is going to feed another large multitude. It says, in those days, chapter 8, verse 1, there was again a large crowd and they had nothing to eat. Now, in those days means probably Jesus is still in the area. There's been no mention of his movement anywhere else. So he's probably over here on kind of the southeast corner over near the Decapolis area. He's still in Gentile territory, probably. So he called his disciples and he said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have remained with me for 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from very far away. And his disciples answered him, where will anyone be able to find enough bread here in such a remote place to satisfy these people? And he asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he commanded the crowd to again sit on the ground, just like he did before. And after he took the 7 loaves, gave thanks, broke them, gave them to his disciples to set before them, and they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish. And after he'd blessed them, he told the disciples to set the fish before them as well. And they ate and were filled, and they collected what was left over of the broken pieces, 7 baskets. Now about 4,000 men were there, and he sent them away. This is a very similar record, very similar miracle to the feeding of the 5,000. There's a different numbers of loaves of bread and fish and how much is left over. I don't know if there's any real particular numerical significance to the differences in the numbers between the feeding of the 5,000 or here and the feeding of the 4,000. What I think is the main point that Mark is using here to include this miracle is they are in the Decapolis area, most likely. And that means this miracle, which mirrors the feeding of the 5,000, is done among Gentiles. That is, I think, what the point is here, is that it is showing God's provision for not just Israel, but also for the rest of the world, the Gentiles representing all the other nations of the world. And again, this is very similar to some of the Old Testament motifs in the wilderness with Israel and God providing manna to feed the people during the time of the Exodus from Egypt. And it's also, again, he doesn't just provide what people need in a sufficient way. It's above and beyond, an overflowing abundance. And then this just kind of reinforces the inclusion of the Gentiles in God's plan and Jesus' identity as the new Moses who provides the true bread for God's people. Then in verse 10, again, and immediately Jesus got into the boat with his disciples and they went to the district of Dalmanutha. And the Pharisees came out and began to dispute with them and demanding a sign from heaven from him to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation demand a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left and got into the boat again and departed to the other side. Now, they were down here in the southeast. They come over here toward Gennesaret, where the area, the region of Dalmanutha is. And then it says that they went to the other side. So probably they then went over somewhere toward Bethsaida. But this religious leaders, these Jewish religious leaders who demand a sign from Jesus, they're kind of putting him to the test. Jesus sighs in his spirit because he doesn't understand why they are demanding this. They want proof from heaven. They want proof from God, essentially. That's what they want. They want a sign. But all the while, they are not listening to Jesus's teachings or the miracles that he does. They're remaining spiritually blind. And this reflects the opposition of the Jewish religious authorities that just continues to build throughout the gospel, culminating in the end with their arrest and torture and crucifixion of Jesus. True faith here that Mark is trying to present doesn't come from signs, but it comes from humility to perceive what God is doing. Jesus critiques the hardened hearts of the Pharisees and religious leaders by demanding a sign from him, all the while ignoring God's clear work that has been happening right in front of them through Jesus. Soon after this, they get back into the boat and go to the other side, Mark says. Now, they're in the boat, and they're going to the other side of the Sea of Galilee or the lake, and it says that they had forgotten to bring bread. And they only had one loaf with them in the boat. And so Jesus ordered them, saying, "Watch out! Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod." They began to discuss with one another that they did not have any bread. And when Jesus realized this, he said to them, "Why are you discussing that you do not have any bread? Do you not yet perceive or understand? Have your hearts become hardened? You have eyes. Do you not see? You have ears. Do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets full of broken pieces did you collect?" They said to him, 12. "And when I broke the seven loaves for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you collect?" And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, "Do you still not understand?" There's a quote that I think really kind of captures the essence of what Jesus is trying to teach here. It's in the commentary on Mark by Morna Hooker in the Black's New Testament commentary series. She says, "Miracles and parables have a parallel function in Mark. To those who have eyes to see and ear to hear, both miracles and parables demonstrate the power of the kingdom of God. But those without ears only hear parables and do not understand the secret of the kingdom, while those without eyes only see amazing acts, so that to them, no sign from heaven is given." In this second scene, following the demand of the religious leaders for a sign from heaven, Jesus is now talking about beware of the leaven or the yeast of the Pharisees. Beware of what they're looking for. And this explanation here by Hooker is they are seeing amazing things, but because they don't have the eyes to actually perceive, they are looking for a sign from heaven, not knowing that they already have it, not knowing that through Jesus' miracles, God is endorsing him as his messianic king, the one who is going to be ruling over his kingdom until the final consummation. So that people who have ears, they just hear parables, but they don't get the secret, what they really mean about the kingdom. And those who have eyes, but they don't really see the power of the kingdom, because all they see are these wonderful things that are happening, these miracles, these fantastic acts of power, but they don't recognize that they're truly signs from God, that they're truly the power of the kingdom. So that's why Jesus follows up and says, "Don't you remember what has happened among you?" He's saying, don't be like the Pharisees. Don't be spiritually blind. They have a corrupting influence, the way that yeast spreads throughout a lump of dough to leaven it, to make it rise. That's like the Pharisees and their corrupting influence, along with Herod as well. So this scene is like a metaphorical teaching moment for Jesus, showing that the hypocrisy and the unbelief of the Pharisees will spread. But beware, watch out, lest you get contaminated as well. Throughout these miracles, the disciples have been shown to have a hardness of heart. They are sort of dull. They're not understanding what Jesus is teaching them and what Jesus is doing. They are pretty close to what the Pharisees are like, questioning Jesus, testing Jesus. And so Jesus is calling his followers here to a spiritual alertness. Even his own disciples are being slow to understand him and are not showing that they have the insight that they need to have by truly listening and truly seeing what God is doing through Jesus' teaching and ministry. And another quote here by Van Eersel, he says in his commentary on Mark, "One would expect greater signs to cause greater understanding. But this is definitely not so with Jesus' followers. But to the contrary, the greater the signs, the greater their misunderstanding. And that's why Jesus says, "Do you still not understand? You are so dull. Can you see what happened with the 5,000? Can you see what happened with the 4,000? Do you get it?" They seem to still be struggling. And so then the last scene, Jesus heals a blind man. Jesus has healed a deaf man and who's deaf and mute, and now he's going to heal a blind man. So they're on the Sea of Galilee, traveling across when he's teaching them about the beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Herod. And they come over and they land at Bethsaida on the northeastern corner of the Sea of Galilee. And they brought to him a blind man and they begged him to touch him. And Jesus, he took hold of the blind man by the hand and brought him out of the village, brought him away from the people. This is kind of what he did as well with the deaf and mute man. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked, "Do you see anything?" After regaining his sight, he said, "I see people, but they look like trees walking around." Then he laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Just like the man who was deaf and mute, his tongue was loosed from whatever was binding it to where he then spoke clearly. Here, the blind man sees clearly. Everything is restored and healed to the way it should be. And again, verse 26, Jesus, he sent him to his home saying, "Do not even enter into the village." Essentially, he's like, "I don't want anybody to see you. You can now see. People don't need to know about it. Go home." Another messianic secret, sort of a motif here where Jesus is trying to have his recognition, his reputation not expand at this time. This two-stage miracle is the only one recorded in the Gospels. And here in Mark, it's the only one where Jesus has to do things twice. I think that Mark is including this here, not just for the healing of someone who is blind as a very unique, miraculous healing, but it's a living parable of the disciples who are gradually starting to come to realize who Jesus is. Their spiritual vision is a little bit blurry, but as we will see in the next session, it becomes a lot clearer. Just as the man here who is blind moved from a no sight to partial sight to full sight, the disciples throughout the Gospel of Mark, and the readers as well, are growing in their understanding of Jesus, moving toward recognizing Jesus' true identity as God's Messiah, which will climax in the next session with Peter's confession that Jesus is the Christ.